Integrating over volume, but it's integration over position over the volume. And also, I didn't get a chance to look into the literature very deeply, but I Googled the negativity of the Wigner function, and a couple of papers came up. This first paper, the author tries to make a connection between the negativity of the Wigner function and non-classicality. So he suggests that, you know, this could be a way that we could quantify non-classicality. And in this paper, which was from Robert Rausendorf's group, so Robert Rausendorf is the same author as the author on the paper that proposed the cluster state model of quantum computation. So here they make a connection between the negativity of the Wigner function and the state having some sort of computational, being able to use it as a computational resource. So if you're interested in knowing more about it, I suggest you check out those papers. Okay, so yesterday, we, toward the end of the lecture, we started talking about spontaneous parametric downconversion, which is the second order nonlinear process, where we shine a strong pump laser on a nonlinear crystal, and then occasionally a single photon from that pump laser splits into a pair of single photons. And this process satisfies energy conservation, and it satisfies momentum conservation. And I mentioned that there's kind of a classical analog to this process. So what I did here is I drew up two classical nonlinear optic phenomena. One of them is called some frequency generation. And so you can you can predict these phenomena using the wave equation that I showed yesterday, which had the polarization as the source. So in some frequency generation, you put in two different fields, two different frequencies. They pass through, but also then you get a third field where the frequency is the sum of the two input frequencies. And so you can think of this as kind of being the reverse process of spontaneous parametric downconversion, where here I have a photon from each beam adding up to give me one photon, while there I had one photon splitting up into two photons. So that's the reverse process. Here we have something called difference frequency generation, where I put in two fields, they both go through, and then I get an output field that is at a frequency that's the difference between these two frequencies. And so I can rearrange these frequencies to satisfy that omega 3 is equal to omega 1 plus omega 2. So one way that I can think about it is that a photon from omega 3 gets split up into two photons in omega 2, so one photon in omega 2 and one photon in omega 1. So you can kind of think about this this pump stimulating the down conversion of a photon from here into those two modes. And if I remove this pump omega 2, then I'll just be left with this spontaneous process where one of these photons gets split into a pair of these two photons. So that's kind of the classical analog of what's happening in spontaneous parametric down conversion. Okay, and we started off yesterday with a simple model of down conversion where I've made some approximations. So I'm just assuming that we're working at a single frequency, so it's a single mode analysis. I'm assuming that the classical pump is really, really strong, so it means that if I'm losing photons from this pump, it's not going to change very much, so I can just treat it classically. I'm in the rotating frame, and also the Hamiltonian that I'm writing down is in the interaction picture. And typically in down conversion, we deal with two different types of down conversion. One of them is called type 1, the other one is called type 2. So I'll start with type 1 first. So in type 1, we have an extraordinary photon that gets split up into two ordinary photons. So what I mean by that is, so these crystals are birefringent crystals. Birefringent materials are materials where the way that the light propagates depends on the direction and polarization of the light. So if I have a crystal and let's see if I can explain this right. If I have a crystal, I can identify something called the optical axis, which is the axis that if I rotate the crystal about that axis, then the polarization, light that's polarized perpendicular to that axis will pass through in a way that doesn't depend on its polarization, as long as it's kind of perpendicular to that axis. And so then light that is perpendicular to that axis is called ordinary light, and light that is parallel to that axis is called extraordinary light. Okay, but you can just think of these as polarizations. Let's say horizontal goes to vertical plus vertical. So this means that the two output photons are going to be the same polarization, and I can model this with a Hamiltonian that looks like this. And yesterday Nick pointed out that it wasn't Hermitian, so the way to fix this is to make this a minus sign, but we still want to keep this this I out the front. And so you can see here that this Hamiltonian is going to be creating pairs of photons and destroying pairs of photons. So then the evolution is given by the unitary. And typically what is done is that we rewrite this as what's known as the squeezing operator. That's a function of this parameter E, and here epsilon depends on the nonlinear strength and the time, which is the time spent inside the crystal, or the time for which the interaction is on. So this kind of gives you a hint of what the state of light coming out of a down conversion source will look like. So if we want to calculate the output state, we act the squeezing operator, in this case, on the vacuum state, because we're assuming that there are no photons in the mode which we're going to be down converting into.
So you assume that what did I know what squeezing is?
Pardon me?
You assume that the squeezing is clear to everyone?
No, I'm going to explain it.
Okay.
But I'm telling you that that this operator S is written like this, and we call it the squeezing operator. So I'm going to define this as the down converted state. So if I take that operator and I act it on the vacuum state, I get something that is a sum of even photon number states. Which I can write out like this. So,
what is the argument of the whole term?
Epsilon. Or E. Yeah, whatever. I guess it's an epsilon. Yep, so it depends on the squeezing parameter, which I will tell you in a minute what that is. And so you can see that the state that comes out is going to be a superposition of the vacuum state and a two-photon state and a four-photon state and so on. And so I can calculate the Wigner function for this state using the equation that I gave you yesterday. And if I plot it as a function of P and Q, I find that it's a Gaussian state that looks very much like our vacuum state, so a coherent state at the origin, but it's now being squeezed. So the variance in the Q quadrature has been reduced, but it's at the expense of the variance in the P quadrature. So this state is still a minimum uncertainty state, so it still satisfies delta Q, delta P is equal to 1, the same way that a coherent state does. But the quantum noise in one of these quadratures is now reduced. So you may remember that at the end of the previous quantum information course, Ray was talking about squeezed states in the LIGO experiments, the gravitational wave detection experiments. So the next generation of LIGO, advanced LIGO, is going to be using these states as an input into the interferometer so that they can increase the precision of these measurements below the quantum noise limit. So that's how you actually make these states. And so the squeezing parameter is the parameter that determines how much you're going to actually squeeze the state. So as eta increases, then this becomes more and more and more squeezed and more and more, more narrow and more elongated. So as an aside, which just occurred to me, we won't be talking about continuous variable quantum computing from this perspective, but there is one model of quantum computing where they encode the information in almost infinitesimally squeezed states. So they squeeze these things so that they're almost eigenstates of P and Q, and then encode the 0 and 1 into, you know, this squeeze state or that squeeze state. And if you have your printout from yesterday with the Wigner functions, then you can see that there's a much nicer picture of the squeeze state than what I can draw here. Okay, so that was type 1 down conversion. Type 2 down conversion has photons that come out that are orthogonal polarizations. So the evolution operator, the Hamiltonian, and therefore the evolution operator, is now going to depend on two modes. So we have a new squeezing operator. Which is going to be given by e to the minus epsilon onto a b minus a dagger b dagger. So now you can see that it's creating pairs of photons and creating pairs of photons and destroying pairs of photons, but in different modes. And because the operator takes the same form as the squeezing operator up there, it's typically known as two-mode squeezing. So I can again apply this operator and act it on the vacuum state. And I get something that looks like the vacuum in both modes plus a single photon in both modes plus two photons in both modes and so on. And so this is important because now we actually have a state that has what we're looking for. So the whole point of this exercise was to try and come up with a source of single photons. So you can see here, even though the state that's produced is going to be a superposition of zero photons or two photons or four photons, using a conditional measurement, you're going to be able to isolate one of these single photon terms. So if I take my Chi2 source and set it up in the type 2 configuration, send in a pump laser that spits out this two-mode squeeze state, and then I put a photon number resolving detector here that goes click when it sees one photon. Then conditional on this detector going click, then I know that I'm going to have created a single photon in this state. And so if you have your squeezing parameter to be sufficiently low so that these higher order terms are negligible, then you don't even really need a photon number resolving detector. You just need an on-off detector. It either says, I see nothing or I see something. And that's how these experiments started off 10, 15 years ago. But now the detectors are better and we have photon number resolving detectors. And so you can turn the pump power up, and as long as you only get a single photon here and the losses in your experiment are low, then you'll be able to create these single photons with higher rates, higher generation rates. Okay, so this was just a single mode analysis, and now we're going to go on to a multi-mode analysis. But before we do that, I'd like to ask, are there any questions about this section first?
Single mode squeeze state. Mm-hmm. On the time of collision, it rotates, isn't it?
Yeah. The question was whether the squeeze state rotates under evolution. And the answer is yes, depending which picture you're in. But yes.
So what's the strength of these lambdas?
Pardon me?
What's the strength of these lambdas? Which one has the greater probability?
Oh, so that depends on the squeezing parameter as well. Let me just try and think how they look like. I think below threshold, and I'll explain what I mean below threshold in a second. I think there would be something like the vacuum component is the highest, and then they get lower and lower. Roughly, you can say that lambda 1 here is going to be equal to lambda 0 squared, and lambda 2 is going to be equal to lambda 1 squared, and lambda 1 is much less than 0, so they do drop off. So that's for below threshold squeezing. Above threshold squeezing, what it does is it squeezes your state, but then displaces it from the origin as well, so it's like having a squeezed coherent state, and there these distributions can kind of move away from the zero and have some sort of distribution like this and a mean depending on the average photon number. So let's move on to a multi-mode analysis. And actually, this is a huge confusion all the time because we use the word mode to refer to so many different things. So here I'm talking about single mode and two-mode squeezing when I'm talking about the polarization modes. But now when I'm talking about a multi-mode analysis, I mean different K modes. But then it also becomes problematic. The multi-frequency photons you saw in the tutorial, the ones that were d omega, phi of omega. So even though that's a multi-frequency photon, it's prepared in the mode given by this distribution. So this can either be called single mode or multimode, depending on what you're talking about. So it's just a huge confusion in the field, and I don't know how to clarify it. I guess we just have to be very careful to keep specifying what we mean by mode. So here, when I'm saying multimode analysis, I mean that we're going to consider all of the frequencies. Okay, and for simplicity, I want to only consider this this term that has the two photons in it, because that's the term that's going to be interesting for us when we're looking at this heralded single photon detection. Okay, so far I've been drawing these photons. I've just been, you know, giving some frequency to these photons, but in reality they're going to have some sort of frequency distribution. So in reality we would have to specify some sort of frequency distribution for photon A, and some sort of frequency distribution for photon B. Let's call it prime. So that definitely complicates things, but it's even worse than that, because typically these photons don't come out uncorrelated in frequency. So it would be okay to do this if each of these photons had its own spectral distribution, but unless you do really, really clever things, it's always going to come out spectrally correlated. And so what we need to do is then specify a joint spectral amplitude to describe these photons. Okay, so we're going to need to specify a two-argument function to describe the joint spectrum. So I'm going to try and draw one in three dimensions, but I'm going to do a very bad job. So here I've drawn two one-dimensional Gaussians. Here what I'm trying to indicate is that there's a two-dimensional Gaussian that's kind of at some angle. So it's not perpendicular to omega A or omega B. And because it's hard to draw these things, typically what we do is we draw the joint spectral amplitudes as a two-dimensional plot. And then we either draw contour plots or have some sort of color map where the color corresponds to the amplitude of these of the joint spectrum. So in the handout that I gave you, I drew a number of realistic, well, simulations of realistic joint spectral amplitudes that you would get from this down conversion crystal. So you can take a look at those. And we're actually going to derive where the form of those joint spectra come from. Okay, so if that's the joint spectral amplitude, then our two photon state is going to take this form. So it'll be an integral over both frequencies, but then the spectrum is given by this joint spectral amplitude. And then we have our creation operators on the vacuum. So we think of this as two photons created with this spectral amplitude. And this is a problem because, can anyone tell me why this is a problem? So I kept using the word correlation, but here, hopefully you can see that it's not just any correlation, it's these two states are entangled in frequency. So if I have two states that are, so that's a pure state, and I have two states that are entangled, and I'm only interested in one of those states, then what's going to happen? Yeah, exactly. So I'm going to have a mixed state in frequency, which is bad because having mixed states is going to reduce the interference in my reduce the visibility in my interferometric network. So yesterday at the end of the tutorial, there was this optional question saying, "What do you think will happen to the Hom dip if I have a mixed state?" Well, it's going to the dip is going to decrease and eventually it'll be flat. So there's going to be no nice interference. So if we can actually calculate the purity of each of these photons from this joint spectral amplitude by doing a Schmidt decomposition. So we can always do it for well-behaved functions. So F of omega A, omega B is decomposed as a sum over these Bs, which are the Schmidt coefficients. And then these functions, G and HK. And these functions are orthonormal functions. So what this means here is that we have each of these terms is a product of separable functions, but then we have to add up a whole bunch of separable functions with this coefficient bk. And so if we want to calculate the purity of each of these photons, what we want to do is first calculate the reduced density matrix of one of them. So we can so let's do it for A. So the reduced density matrix of A is going to be the trace over B of this state, which I'm not going to calculate for you, but you can imagine how it goes. So to do the trace, we have to integrate out one of these other frequencies. And then the purity is going to be equal to the trace of rho A squared. So hopefully you remember that from Joe's course. And because these are nice orthonormal functions, the calculation actually goes really easily and the functions disappear. And you get out something that is just depends on these Schmidt coefficients, bk to the power of 4. And so you can kind of intuitively see that if this f was a separable function already, if it only had, if f was, let's say, g times h, and it only had one term, then I would only have one Schmidt coefficient, and that Schmidt coefficient would be equal to 1. So then my sum over the Schmidt coefficients would just be 1. So I would get a purity of 1. But anything less than that is going to reduce my purity.
When you check this in photon, mm-hmm. is there any way you can check what frequency it's at?
Yeah. So typically the detectors are going to have a really broad frequency response, much broader than the shape, the size of these joint spectra. So you're going to have to integrate over all the frequencies. If you had something that was had a really, really narrow frequency, then you lose your time resolution because there's this inverse relationship between your frequency resolution and time resolution. So I'm guessing that that would have other implications for your experiments. But typically, the detectors are much broader than what we see here. But you're right that if you could detect at a single frequency, it would solve your problem. Okay, so our goal is going to be to try and come up with a joint spectral amplitude that is separable so that we can write as just a product of the function over omega A and a function over omega B. And to do that, we need to understand where the shape of the joint spectrum comes from. So I want to derive that for you. So just to make things simple, I'm going to treat everything to be in a one-dimensional waveguide, so I only need to worry about the z component of the field, but I don't need to worry about the x and y components. So I can write down the interaction Hamiltonian to be a integral over z. And the interaction is going to be on only inside this waveguide. So here, L is the length of the waveguide. So the interaction goes from minus L on 2 to L on 2. It's going to depend on this nonlinear strength of the interaction. And then we're going to have 3 fields. Okay, so this interaction is between 3 fields, the pump field and the down-converted field, so the ordinary and extraordinary ones. And it's written in terms of the positive and negative frequency components. So that's the total field, and it can be split up into the positive and negative frequency components. And we can write each of these components. So I have an integral over omega j. Okay, so you may remember in yesterday's lecture I talked about how we quantize the field. So we start with Maxwell's equations, write down the wave equation, solve it, and then get the electric field, and then we promote the amplitudes to be these operators. So this is it's going through the same process, but doing it inside a waveguide rather than doing it in free space. And then also taking the limit to infinity. So rather than having a sum over the k's, we now have this integral over the omegas. And it's an integral of over omega because we're only considering one dimension. So the integral over k in one dimension can just be turned into an integral over omega. This function a of omega, it's just what you saw in the previous expression. It was the square root, which had all these. Actually, I can write it down. So it's just a coefficient you get from quantizing inside a material with a refractive index. And even though this is a function of frequency, typically it's going to be very flat over the frequency range of interest. So we're going to pull it out the front in a minute, just to simplify things. Okay, and here we have the plane wave modes, except now they're also functions of the wave number, which itself is a function of frequency, because we're going to have dispersion inside this material. So the wave number is going to be different depending on what the frequency of the field is. Okay, and the negative frequency part is just equal to the complex conjugate of the positive frequency part. Okay, and then the other assumption we're going to make again is that we're going to consider the pump field to be classical. So this is going to be the expression for O and E. So J is equal to O and E, but for the pump field, we're just going to say that E of P is going to be some sort of function that gives us the temporal profile. So imagine some sort of pumped laser, pulsed laser. So each pulse has some sort of temporal profile as it's going through. That's given by that shape. And then we have a term that depends on the wave number as well. Okay, and again, our output state is going to be given by acting the evolution operator on the vacuum state. Except now our Hamiltonian depends on time, so we're going to have to integrate over time. Okay, and as I said, we're going to assume that these higher order terms are negligible, and we're just going to focus on this two photon term. So we'll just write down what the first order term is. And I'm going to, like I said, I'm going to bring this A out the front. I'll assume it's constant. And I don't want to be writing out all of these constants, so I'm just going to say that the output state is proportional to what? But you don't want to sit here having me rewrite all these constants. In any case, you have to normalize it at the end, so that's fine. Okay, so what I'm going to do is now put all of those fields into the Hamiltonian, and then take the first order term of this and act it on the vacuum state. So, oh, and I'm also going to take the limits, the time limits to infinity, which the hand-wavy argument for that is that the interaction is going to be zero outside of the crystal, before it, the light gets into the crystal and after it gets into the crystal, so we can just take those limits to infinity and it'll be taken care of anyway. So really the integral should be from like the time that you enter and the time that you leave, but it doesn't matter since the interaction is zero outside. Okay, so I have my integral over t, my integral over z, over the length of the crystal. I now have an integral over the pump, which I will explain in a second where it came from. Integral over the down-converted fields. Oh my goodness. Okay, I'll just write it and then I'll explain everything in a second. Okay, where? Okay, so what I've done is taken this function A of t, so that's the temporal profile of the pulse, and just written it as a Fourier transform of the spectral profile of the pulse. So that's given me an extra, well, I can put these p's there. It's given me an extra integral over omega p, and it's given me an extra e to the minus I omega t term. So what you can see, kind of things that are starting to show up, we're going to now have something that will give us energy conservation here, and something that'll give us momentum conservation here. Okay, does anyone want to guess what the next step should be? Is there something here that looks obvious? So this term, this integral over t, seems like it would be pretty easy to evaluate, right? So I'm going to get this bit. And evaluate that integral over t to give me, can you see that? To give a delta function over over those frequencies. So that'll simplify things a lot. And then once I have this delta function, it makes it really easy to evaluate another one of these integrals. So the integral over omega p is the one that I'm going to do. So what that means is just replacing all of the omega p's with omega o plus omega e. So I'm going to do both of those in one step. Okay, so I've just done those integrals, and I've rewritten this exponential over k's. I've now introduced this function delta k, which is called the phase mismatch, and it tells us how the phase matching inside the crystal happens. And so now we're almost where we want to be. Where do we want to be? We want to be right there where I have a state that's just written in terms of a function over two creation operators acting on the vacuum state. So we're almost there. We just need to do this integral over z. So I'll just rewrite things slightly. I'll say let's define this function as this integral over z. And so you can see that this is, it's just a Fourier transform of a top hat function. And you might remember that the Fourier transform of a top hat function is a sinc function. Where the sinc function is sine x on x. So we get what we wanted. Okay, so we have, okay, and let me just draw. Okay, so this is what I can write the plot the phase matching function as a function of delta k, and it looks like this. So it's kind of like a Gaussian, but it has these ripples on the side. And so the spectrum is going to be given by the product of, okay, this is kind of, is it, I don't know if it's confusing. So here I'm writing phi as a function of the two frequencies, and here I've got it as a function of delta k, but that's because delta k itself is a function of omega zero, omega o and omega e. So for the last part of the lecture, I'll just kind of sketch out what these phase matching functions look like. So usually to make things simple, what people do is they approximate that that sync function as a Gaussian. So you can so if you, I mean, when you do rigorous calculations, you need to keep the sync there, but there is some merit to doing it this way, and I'll show you what it is in a second. Yeah, no, you can laugh. So where gamma is equal to 0.193. Okay, so if I approximate it as a Gaussian, it'll make it easier for me to draw. So then phi of, so the phase matching function will be roughly equal to L times e to the minus gamma delta k L on 2 squared. So I'm now going to plot. So the pump function is always going to be along the anti-diagonal. And if it's a Gaussian spectrum, then this pump will have a Gaussian profile along here. Then our phase matching function, we have a little bit of control over how it's oriented. But it might look something like that. And because I'm approximating it as a Gaussian, it'll have a Gaussian profile here. And then if we take a product of these two things, we get the joint spectral amplitude. And so it'll be the overlap region will be something like this. Okay, and since we're out of time, so the next thing I wanted to do is to show you guys what we can actually control in order to move this phase matching function around and change its width and change its orientation so that we can arrange things in such a way that this joint spectrum is nicely decorrelated. And then once it's decorrelated, that means that our heralded photons are going to be pure in frequency. So in the handout, you've got some examples of the of different phase matching functions, and you can see some of them are more correlated and some of them are less correlated. So tomorrow I'll just show you what physical things in the crystal we can change in order to achieve those decorrelated ones. Are there any questions?
Nick? Here you've been dealing with a 1D wave guide.
Yeah, yeah.
So the phase matching would be a lot easier if you do 3D. You can sort of three dimensions of the crystal so that your momentum can sort of go in opposite directions.
Maybe we should take this offline. I don't think things are easier in 3D. They're more complicated.
Okay.
But let's wrap the class up, and then we can have a chat offline about that.